increase over their previous year's pay and a record 399 times more than the take-home of typical American workers. Some context can help here. Back in 1965, top U.S. CEOs averaged just 20 times more than the annual compensation of typical American workers. In 1989, a quarter century later, that gap was still only running 59 to 1. The gap since then has multiplied nearly sevenfold. Overall, U.S. CEO compensation has increased 1,460% since 1978, adjusting for inflation. The pay increase for typical U.S. workers over that same time span, just 18%. Rising corporate executive compensation, note EPI's Josh Bivens and Jory Kondra has fueled the growth of top 1% and top 0.1% incomes, leaving fewer of the gains of economic growth for ordinary workers and widening the gap between the very high earners and the bottom 90%. This increase in U.S. executives' pay has extended far beyond CEO suits. All top corporate officers have feasted in the fabulous windfall. Amazon, for instance, last year generously shared the wealth well beyond the chief executive level. Amazon CEO Andrew Jassy ended the year up $212.7 million. But Amazon's web services chief Adam Selipsy had no reason to complain either. His compensation for the year, $81.4 million. David Clark, Amazon's worldwide consumer chief, enjoyed a lucrative year as well. His pay totaled $56 million. Amazon's most typical warehouse workers, meanwhile, took home $31,705 last year. The pay gap between U.S. corporate execs and workers gives no sign of shrinking anytime soon. And that shouldn't surprise us. Corporate executives sit on each other's boards of directors. These executives have little incentive to rein in CEO pay in hard economic times and every incentive to insist that only continued high executive pay can keep in place the quality leadership that hard times so dramatically demand. Just how much does all U.S. current corporate executive compensation contribute to the wealth of America's wealthiest? Quite a bit. Between 1978 and 2020, the latest year with comparable stats available, the overall inflation-adjusted annual earnings of nation's top 0.1% jumped 385%. CEO compensation during those same years, EPI notes, grew nearly four times as fast. The bottom line, America's distribution of income and wealth will remain ridiculously top-heavy until people start limiting the rewards, continuing to rush and gush into U.S. corporate executive suits. That limit could come in any one of several different forms. Let's start with taxes. In the two decades after the Second World War, individual income over $200,000 faced a federal income tax rate that annually hovered around 90%. That tax pressure served to deflate executive compensation. Why bother skimming for outrageously high executive pay, after all, when Uncle Sam stood ready to tax away most of any windfall? Another approach to corporate pay reform, limiting the gap between executive and worker compensation, has been a steadily gaining momentum over the past decade. San Francisco and Oregon's Portland now levy higher tax rates on executive pay that runs over 100 times worker pay. At the state level, Legislative proposals along the same line are gaining ground. Nationally, as inequality.org details, progressive lawmakers are working to link federal government contracting and subsidies to CEO worker pay differentials. Their goal, denying federal dollars to corporations with wide pay gaps between executives and workers. Corporate America's continuing failure to limit those gaps plays out dramatically in the latest Credit Suisse Research Institute annual comprehensive stats on national mean and median individual wealth. One example, the United States last year averaged just over $579,000 in wealth per adult, almost double France's $322,000 average. But the most typical, the median French adult held a net worth of just under $140,000, almost $50,000 more than the wealth of the most typical U.S. adult. And on the U.S. rampant inequality and discrimination, Global Times wrote, according to the Native American Rights Fund, Native American voters face 11 common barriers to political participation, including limited government services and a lack of funding for elections. Canada shocked the world with the discovery of alarming numbers of children's remains and unmarked Aboriginal burials at the site of boarding school. The incarceration rate of Indigenous Australian people is 15 times higher than that of non-Indigenous Australians, and the death rate in detention is on the rise, causing family separation and seriously undermining the development of Indigenous communities. What's more, the U.S. systematic discrimination and inequality faced by Indigenous people has not been improved by the implementation of post-pandemic economic and social recovery plans. American Indians and Alaska Natives have long had far higher unemployment rates than other ethnic groups, and the gap has widened during the post-pandemic economic recovery period. According to the recent review conclusions of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, Indigenous peoples' food security and women's rights are not guaranteed, and the willingness and measures of the United States of America to fulfill its commitment to the protection of Indigenous peoples' rights are seriously insufficient. It is noted that the welfare of Indigenous children in the U.S. is still not effectively protected, and violence and crimes against Indigenous women and girls are still rampant, which greatly hinders the recovery of Indigenous communities from the harm caused by the pandemic.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
gold.
Such as gold.
金貝.
金貝.
Gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
El oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name, and he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Byzant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500. Well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a 1,000-year coin, if you like.
The Byzant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Byzant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the bezant survived for 1,000 years. The bezant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you're a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge round them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhuo and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners, who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population, which had been devastated by the plague, was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is not what you see in the flamboyant Hollywood movies. Normal life in the U.S. might surprise you, as the number of people without a stable place to call home has increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800 since the pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites. Stay tuned, please. The Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They are frequently overlooked in the debate on how we solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions." Works Fund combines paid work in social enterprise with transitional housing and support services for people not currently eligible for Housing First resources yet who are not self-resolving off the streets or out of shelters. Work programs act as a bridge for marginalized homeless populations with the capacity and desire to work to re-enter the workforce and obtain permanent housing. Tens of thousands of Americans fit that description. Solutions like Work benefit not only their target population, but also the larger community through earnings, cost savings, increased labor hours, and more available housing. The three-pronged approach of the Work model provides primary and secondary benefits, while its philosophy and implementation design allow for community integration and buy-in in a way that other strategies cannot. There has never been more urgency for employment-based solutions because of the ongoing labor shortage. The roughly 11 million jobs now unfilled represent a historic opportunity to increase employment among the homeless population. Employers are struggling to find workers, while over 70% of people experiencing homelessness are unemployed. And even those who are technically working are really underemployed. With more public support, Work programs can develop relationships between local employers and municipal governments. Hill continued, homelessness is a symptom of many systematic failures of policy and practice in housing, behavioral health, workforce development, and the criminal justice system. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. It's past time to encourage innovation to develop programs that take into account the diversity of needs of people experiencing homelessness and promote the belief that those on the streets can and should be seen as assets to the community, as contributing members of society. Today, with homelessness on the rise in the U.S., U.S. citizens are perplexed by the lack of success their communities are having to adequately address this crisis. Also, Politico wrote, rising homelessness is tearing California cities apart. A crew of state workers arrived early one hot summer day to clear dozens of people camped under a dusty overpass near California's capital. The camp's residents gathered their tents, coolers, and furniture and shifted less than 100 feet across the street to city-owned land where they have been ever since. But maybe not for much longer. The city of Sacramento is taking a harder line on homeless encampments and is expected to start enforcing a new ban on public camping by the end of the month, if the courts allow. Also, Times of San Diego wrote, the first statewide snapshot of California's homelessness crisis since the pandemic hit reveals that the number of people without a stable place to call home increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800. That's based on a Call Masters analysis of the federal government's point-in-time count, a biennial head count of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters tallied in by California cities and counties earlier this year for the first time since 2019. Homelessness experts mostly attribute the rise to precipitous drops in earnings during the pandemic among Californians already teetering on the edge. They also point to a worsening housing affordability crisis that is decades in the making. We have to solve this rotting core in the center of California, which is that we are a million units short of housing for exemplary low-income workers, said Margot Cochelle, director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. While homelessness grew by 15%, roughly the same space as in recent years, something experts credit to pandemic-era safety nets like rental assistance, eviction moratoria, and stimulus checks. The data also indicates the problem has gotten worse for the state's Latino population. Critics are quick to point out the state is spending more than $14 billion on homelessness, but advocates say its response is just now beginning. The price tag is bigger now, said Tomika Moss, founder and chief executive of All Home, a San Francisco-based homeless policy organization, saying, meanwhile, the inflow is killing us. The numbers show the state's investment in shelters is bearing fruit. California created more than 14,000 shelter beds between 2019 and 2021. And local organizations reported this year the number of people staying in emergency and longer stay shelters ballooned by nearly the same amount, from 42,800 to 57,200 people, a 33% increase since 2019. Christopher Ware, president of the Center for Homeless Inquiry, said, most people, most politicians, when they talk about homelessness, it's we're going to build X number of shelters. It's shelter, shelter, shelter. Well, all of this construction of shelters doesn't really change the scope of the problem. Meanwhile, the unsheltered count, or the number of people staying in tents, tarps, cars, and other spaces unfit for human habitation, grew by 7% between 2019 and 2022 to 116,600 people. That's a bomb, but perhaps not reflective of the growing palpability of the crisis that dominates local headlines, political debates, and neighborhood discussions.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Someone who folds their arms instead of undertaking their duties, obligations, and responsibilities, instead of using their own abilities, and instead expect Allah to work a miracle on their behalf, such a person should know that the Quran utterly rejects this attitude. Allah delivers a harsh rebuke to the Israelites who told Musa, Go ahead, you and your Lord, and fight. We will be sitting right here. Surah 5, verse 24. In other words, you go and fight our enemies and let us know when you've won. Then we'll come. The Quran rejects this utterly. This approach is that of the Israelites, whom Allah cursed and denied the joys of faith. This is not worthy of someone who claims to submit to Allah. This is not the meaning of trusting in Allah, this idea that has gained currency amongst people. I'm saying this so everyone will hear and understand. This idea people have in which they say, Allah needs to fix this, no one can do anything about this. This is an error. If no one could do anything, if no one had it in them to fight corruption and make the world better, then Allah would not have sent prophets. He would not have summoned people to follow the prophets. He would not have given the prophets weighty messages to deliver to this world. Well, we see that Allah has sent people to fight corruption and make the world better, and we see that they are human beings. Therefore, you should know that it is up to human beings to fight human corruption. So then what does it mean to place one's trust in Allah?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Tawakkul means that in every situation you rely on Allah and place your hopes in Him. Notice that the definition I am giving here, to rely on Allah and place your hopes in Him in every situation, makes trusting in Allah a basis for action rather than an obstacle to it, and a source of motivation rather than a source for indifference. Have you seen how when some people face difficulties in life, when they go through hardship and they exhaust every visible means at their disposal to rectify their situation without success, what do they do? Have you seen or heard this? They will do one of a few things. Either they will surrender, when nothing they do seems to work, or they will resign themselves to fate, or they will take the path of of least resistance. They won't give up, but in practice, they will do whatever is easiest. They won't make any effort to change the circumstances and go wherever life takes them. But even if this person has not visibly surrendered like in the first case, inwardly their mentality is the same. So this is one response people have when they face hardships.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
India, Singapore, and the Philippines are among those building new labs certified as biosafety level 3 or above, but some researchers worry about the cost and risks. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article published in Nature. Stay tuned, please. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, plans are afoot to build more than 40 high-level biosafety labs around the world, including in India, the Philippines, and Singapore. Investments in biosafety labs often follow major epidemics, but some researchers are concerned about the growing number of facilities that will handle some of the world's most dangerous pathogens. Some scientists worry about the huge cost of maintaining biosafety level 3 and BSL-4 facilities, whereas others fear the risks posed by these labs, such as the possibility of creating pathogens that are more dangerous or of microorganisms escaping. But researchers in the countries that plan to build these labs say they are needed. The lack of high security labs in some regions became particularly apparent during the pandemic because work on the live virus that causes COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 must be done at a BSL-3 or BSL-4 facility. The pandemic exposed the weakness of health systems worldwide in recognizing and responding to emerging threats in public health, said Bharati Pawar, India's Minister for Health and Family Welfare, at a ceremony to mark the start of construction of one of the nation's new BSL-3 labs in Bengaluru last month. India's plans are among the most ambitious. The country is in the process of building 5 BSL-3 facilities and is planning at least another 9 more. 4 institutions have also said they will construct BSL-4 labs with the highest level of containment too. India currently only has one such facility that is operational, and the government has committed to building 4 new national institutes of virology, 2 of which will also eventually handle BSL-4 pathogens. BSL-3 labs are designed so that scientists can safely work with potentially lethal and inhalable pathogens in a contained environment. Experiments are conducted in sealed workspaces in which the air is filtered and not recirculated, and the entrance to the facility is typically secured by self-closing doors. BSL-4 facilities in which researchers work with fatal pathogens that can spread through aerosols and for which vaccines or treatments are lacking or limited require extra security measures. These labs are isolated from other sections of a building and have a dedicated air supply, and researchers change clothes and shower before entering and leaving the premises. The pandemic has raised public awareness of emerging diseases and the need for labs, creating a favorable environment for these investments, says Pragaya Yadav, a virologist who heads the BSL-4 facility at the National Institute of Virology in Pune. A country India's size needs more high containment facilities, she says. Elsewhere in Asia, Kazakhstan, Singapore, and the Philippines have announced plans to build their first BSL-4 facilities. Beyond the region, the United States has committed to adding another BSL-4 lab to its existing group of about a dozen maximum containment facilities. And Russia announced last year that it will build 15 BSL-4 labs. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, plans to build 27 BSL-4 labs have been announced worldwide, say Gregory Koblenz, a biodefense researcher at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia, and Philippa Lensos, a biosecurity researcher at King College London, who have tracked the number and distribution of BSL-4 facilities globally. But some researchers question the need for so many extra BSL-3 and BSL-4 labs and note the hefty cost of maintaining them. Ilich Mombo, a virologist at the International Center for Medical Research of France while in Gabon, says that roughly 10% of his lab's budget goes on experiments, whereas around 90% is spent on checking, maintaining, and repairing the facility. When instruments break, they cost a lot to fix, and there are no trained technicians in the region. Researchers are sometimes sent to work elsewhere, says Mombo. Thomas Kiazik, a virologist who heads the high contaminant operation at the Galveston National Lab in Texas, a BSL-4 facility, says that his team's lab receives close to $12 million a year from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases just for maintenance and operations. Some $2 million of which is spent on 24-hour security, and about $2 million is required to power the ventilation, heating, and air conditioning, as well as to operate the BSL-3 portion of the lab. Rohani Navarro, a vet at Philippines National Institute of Molecular Biology and Biotechnology in Manila, says she and her colleagues are constantly writing grant applications just to maintain their BSL-3 operations. She says the annual certification, which involves a thorough safety review, costs some $40,000. High contaminant facilities can become like a white elephant that isn't used. Some researchers also worry that having more of these labs will increase the risks associated with them, including of workers being infected. Scientists say labs often struggle to find well-trained staff to run high containment facilities. Kim Sells, who researches health policy and health systems at the nonprofit organization Alliance for Improving Health Outcomes in Manila, says in a survey of lab practices in the Philippines, found that biosafety officers had only a weak understanding of biosafety. More labs could also lead to more high-risk research, such as gain-of-function studies, in which pathogens are sometimes modified, which could make them more dangerous to people. A large body of evidence suggests that SARS-CoV-2 jumped to humans from wild animals, probably at a live animal market. But some scientists say they cannot exclude the possibility that the pandemic started with an enhanced virus that escaped from a lab, raising broader concerns about the risks of gain-of-function research. But some scientists say new biosafety labs could lead to better safety practices. These labs help researchers work more safely than they could without them, says Gigi Grovel, a biosecurity scientist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, adding, "Assuming that people are trained well and equipment is updated, I am not concerned by the array of BSL-3 labs."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh, and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege, and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mehdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Msuya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken